I was on one of those shows where they do your DNA, and I'm related to Gloria Steinem.
Oh my God! Well, I can see that. You know, you have a very similar this.
Your mouth
is very similar. Your smile.
But that was the big
I
reveal.
I think you're actually similar. You have some similar movements. You know, and she's quite funny. She can really tell a good joke. You know, and she's wonderful.
This is Don't Ask Tig. I'm still Tig Notaro, and you're still asking. Today, we are so excited to have author and activist Rebecca Walker here with us. Welcome, Rebecca.
Well, thank you, Tig Notaro. I'm super happy to be here with you.
Rebecca, what is your version of how we met? And then I'll tell you mine.
Oh my gosh. My version is of us. Well, obviously, we were on the Transparent set. We were both playing the wives of Tammy, the ex-wives, right? So there was all that energy of Transparent and Joey, and it was kind of cool. And I was wearing this weird white dress. And you were wearing this cool suit. We were on the golf cart, and I think I was futzing with my hair or something. And you started making fun of me and taking a picture. And my memory is of feeling your cool, warm, honest energy and feeling really connected to you right away. And I remember us in our white outfits.
That's very similar to how I remember it. But I also remember I took such an immediate liking to you that I remember I came running into your trailer and knocking on your door. And
yes.
And I was demanding a friendship, and I was demanding that you consider working on my TV show that I had just gotten. And I think I had known you for an hour that day. Maybe it was a little longer, because we were not only on Transparent and in those white outfits, we were in a wedding scene that was in the scorching heat all day. And so we were sitting next to each other and we were cracking up. And I had so much fun with you. And I was just like, how do I get this person in my life? And I just went knocking on your trailer door and was like, will you be my friend and will you work in my writer's room?
And yes, I do remember that now. And I loved it. And I was like, of course. And I think that's because we had talked about the show. And I was really, I immediately took to trying to help figure out how to do it, mm-hmm. how to tell the story. And then you were like, yeah, that sounds good. That you know.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And then it went from there.
I mean, just thinking back again and seeing your face on Zoom, it's just all really bringing me back to how crucial you were to that show and that room and what we were doing with the show, what we were trying to do. And I'm just, I'll forever be grateful for your contributions to making the show what it was, because I've walked away just so proud of it. And I think, God, what if I hadn't met Rebecca that day at work?
Yes. But one of the things I remember about the room, and I was so self-conscious about it, I was always saying, no, we cannot do that. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Like when we were trying to figure out the black character, I was like, no, absolutely not. She's not going to be like covered in scarves, working at some kind of shop. You know, she's going to do this and she's going to do that. And then, you know how when you go into a room, you're supposed to say, well, that's a good idea. But what about if we do it this way? And we could maybe think about it this way. I was always saying, no, that's absolutely not good. We cannot do that. That's offensive in every way to all of our black viewers, all of our whatever, you know, whoever I was thinking about at the moment. And you all were so good about that with me. You were like, okay, well, let's work with that. We hear you. And I mean, we got into some very deep waters in there.
Yes, very deep and very heightened conversations, but they were all so so enlightening. And I'm very thankful for that time. So again, thank you for being a part of that.
Thank you, Tig.
You had the real inside scoop of working on the show, writing on the show, contributing, and then knowing me in person as a real human being, which the show was based on a real human being. But
that's true. But I do think, actually, now that I reflect, that you were able to access a little bit more of the emotional feelings that you were having around your mother's death on the show in a way that we didn't see in the writer's room every day. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a kind of, to be able to see your face, you know, in the scenes when she died, when she reappeared, to sort of grieve with your fake stepfather, you know, that was all very revealing and resonant in a way that, you know, when you're in person, you don't necessarily go deep into that space. We know that you're having it. We've read, we know the story, but mm-hmm. but it's not written on your body in the same way. So that was really different and lovely to see.
And
did you feel that way?
Absolutely. I mean, I had to rehash certain things on the show that I didn't feel like I was necessarily struggling with on a day-to-day basis. And then I'd have to go back in time, in essence, and kind of replay that. And it wasn't really matching up with where I was in my life. And so, but I also found it healing in ways, and especially so much of it with my mother. There's a moment where I'm lying in the hospital bed and my mother comes to my side and on the show. And my mother was dead in real life by the time I was hospitalized. So I never had that moment, but there was something so moving about my mother being there. And I thought that Rhea, who played my mother, just did such an exceptional job. But it was very, very moving for me.
Yes.
Your mother is Alice Walker. What is it like for you to have a larger-than-life mother or family member? Do you have advice for people with that? Because I certainly had that. I feel like that's also where I connected yes. with you.
Yes. Well, I do think that having a larger-than-life... I mean, my mom is kind of a... Not kind of, but she is. She's a real cultural icon. And I grew up, you know, with people saying, I have an altar to your mother in my bedroom. And, you know, what a dream. How lucky you are. What, you know, you're so blessed to have your mother as your mother. And obviously, all of that is true. But at the same time, I think that having a mom in that position kind of forces you to, if you want to survive that, tell your own story, to find your own truth, and to make sure that you're not kind of sublimated or not sort of subsumed by her story of who you are. Mm-hmm. So she wrote about me a lot. And there was a moment that I realized that people would always perceive me through the stories that she told, and that I really needed to, in order to become my own person and individuate and mature, write my own story. And so, you know, my second book, Black, White, and Jewish, was really about telling my own experience of what it was like to be both her daughter and my father's daughter and a child of the civil rights movement from my perspective as someone who was both blessed by the experience, supported by the experience, but also injured by the experience. And I think, you know, my mom and I had a big falling out around that. And, you know, that was tough. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot more respect for each other now that she has been able to accept my truth in the way that I had to accept hers. But it's not easy, you know. Mm-hmm. I think now I'm on the other side of it. You know, for a while I used to call myself AWD when I was joking Alice Walker's daughter, because people would introduce me as Alice Walker's daughter all the time. And it was like, okay, the AWD story, you know. And now, you know, she's in a different place. I'm in a different place. And she often says, you know, you're the mommy now, you know, and it's like, she's RWD. She's, you know, the roles have reversed in this very interesting way. But I think it's important to just find your own truth, you know?
I think you've done such a phenomenal job in doing so. And I know for myself, you told me that Alice was your mother, but it was such a... I didn't meet you because of that or knowing that. And I always kind of have to remind myself that that is your mother because you are such an individual to me. And I have my own connection to you that you're not AWD, but I fully understand and relate to that. Again, even though my mother was a very different person than yours, but she was larger than life, and I similarly to you, I feel like I've done my own thing, but there's those pieces of our mother and our mothers that we carry with us that connect us forever. But but yeah, I just think you've done a tremendous job of doing your own thing and telling your own story or stories. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And thank you for being on the show. And you know, we have to still give advice. We haven't even started giving advice yet.
Yes, but I want to just say this. I feel that your integrity was the thing that drew me to you. Your honesty, your integrity, your refusal to back down, and your determination to stand up for what was right. And you have a fearlessness around that that is very rare. And it's why I am happy that we're still connected and why I care so much about you. All right. So let's answer some questions.
Thank you. That's so nice. The feeling is beyond mutual. And I just felt an instant connection to you that I can't imagine will ever go away. So
yes,
we love each other.
Okay,
now let's
fest.
Help. Let's take our love and let's help the first person here. Little man. That's who is writing in. Little man.
Little man. Okay.
Little man writes, my 13-year-old recently came out as gay and non-binary. They have always loved having sleepovers and often ask to have other kids spend the night. Many of their friends are also queer and gender nonconforming. How should I proceed responsibly with overnight hangs? This is new territory for me, and while I want to have a supportive open home, I also want to keep everyone safe and comfortable. Right now, I can ban sleepovers entirely because of the pandemic, but that will only buy me so much time. Help. That, I haven't even thought about that.
That is a deep question. Oh my goodness.
We spoke too soon when we said we could help, maybe. My instinct right off reading this is I would want to talk to all of the parents and see where all of the parents stood and see what everyone's comfort level is. And it might just call for an open discussion between the parents and all of the kids and talk about respecting boundaries. And that would be my initial instinct.
I think that's a great instinct. Very smart, Tig. What would I do? I think I would really, yes, it's the same idea, just talking. You know, I would talk to my non-binary child about my expectations around intimacy at their age and how important it is to be ready to be intimate with another person, the ways in which one has to respect oneself and one's body and the bodies of other people and the psyches of other people. And, you know, to have that as the foundation and the core, you know, so that no matter what situation your child is in, they have a real understanding of how to be a responsible sexual being in the world.
Yeah, I think that's a good combination of discussions because it feels like sitting down with 13-year-olds that are already open enough and in touch with themselves to express that they're non-binary or queer or whatever the label is, it feels mm-hmm. like young adults, you know, children mm-hmm. that could have mm-hmm. a conversation if it was presented in a way like, listen, typically this is how sleepovers work. We don't have the typical family. We don't have the typical life that the rest of the world might have. And so with our atypical mm-hmm. situation, let's put everything out on the table and say, this is how it would typically work. This is our situation. How do we make everybody comfortable, including your parents? And I think that through that, as well as what you're saying, Rebecca, that little man could come mm-hmm. up with a reasonable solution. I bet these kids are cool mm-hmm. and open mm-hmm. to problem solving with their parents. And I would be very touched and think my parents were cool if they were trying to present a way to have a successful sleepover with teenagers that were gay or non-binary or that yeah. would, I think, make me feel like I would want to do right and I wouldn't want to let them down. I'd want to show them that I can be responsible.
And if you have that kind of conversation with the kids, I think you can present it as, you know, look, I want to learn from you because I don't have your experience and I don't understand, you know, the difference between being non-binary and being cisgendered. I don't understand how that works in this kind of environment. So teach me, you know, and I think they would really
yeah.
be into that.
Yeah. Show me how this will work and let's get to a place where we can all say yes.
Yeah. How do you think it will work?
We did it, Rebecca.
Yeah. Go ahead, little man, and then let us know how it goes somehow.
Yeah. You got to let us know, little man.
Okay, what's our next question?
Well, we're going to have more questions after the break, Rebecca, so hang tight.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
I just feel like we are surrounded in this world by bullshit.
So how can you know what's real and what's not? Science versus. That's how. We answer questions like, does anti-aging skincare actually work? And what is your true personality type? And to answer these questions, we don't use opinions. We dive into the scientific studies, talk to the experts, and put it in a podcast that I know you are gonna love. Listen to Science versus on Spotify.
And we're back. Rebecca, this relates to our first question. How old were you when you first started thinking about feminism?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, Gloria Steinem's my godmother. My mother's Alice Walker, who's like the mother of womanism. I was, you know, basically a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old when I was, you know, at the Ms. Magazine offices, crawling around and walking around and testing toys and developing critiques on whether they were gender neutral or sexist. I don't know that I ever had a moment where I started thinking about feminism. It was just kind of
woven in
the water. It was in everything. Yeah. I mean, there was no moment of awakening, which is why when I got to college and I saw how many women were turning away from feminism and thought it was, you know, the F word and that all feminists were man-hating and they didn't want anything to do with it, I was so shocked, you know, because I didn't have that experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the first time, I'm trying to remember if there's any moment Yeah, no, I mean, I was, you know, Our Bodies, Ourselves was like my, somebody gave it to me when I was, you know, 8 or something. I mean, I had all of the sort of classic feminist texts as my...
Yeah, it kind of seems like that would always just have been there for you.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Whereas other people move away from home and go off to college or, you know, travel the world and discover the things that were just bubbling within your own home and surroundings.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question. Alex writes, I'm a 13-year-old lesbian. I always apologize when it isn't necessary. I want to stop because it's enabling to the patriarchy, but the words I'm sorry just come out. What should I do?
Wow. Alex, well, you just have to stop apologizing. I mean, I know that that may be easier said than done. I'm wondering what you're apologizing for.
That's a good question.
I mean, I think that really you should only apologize if you've injured someone or done something that feels fundamentally incorrect, you know, to you, and you want to make some kind of amends and rebuild a connection and a bond with that person and take care of their feelings. And that could be, you know, not just one individual, but it could be about apologizing for participating in white supremacy in a certain way or, you know, something else. But fundamentally, you know, if you haven't hurt someone, I don't think you need to be apologizing. So I think I think you should look deeply into what an apology is, what it is good for and what it is not good for. And if it is not about building a bridge or healing a rift that you have caused, those are not words that you need to be using, you know? Never apologize for yourself and your beliefs and what you want in life. You have a right to those things.
It's true. It's you know, as a comedian, I'm very, it kind of reminds me of when people say, I'm just kidding. It's very different. It's a little, it's lighter, but it's the same thing of if you make a joke, just let it be a joke. You don't have to jump in and say, I'm just kidding, because it's
exactly. it
ruins the joke.
Yes, exactly. And I think what you're saying about the patriarchy, I think you said the patriarchy, mm-hmm. you know, is that if you apologize, you let everyone off the hook. If you say, you know, if you have a critique and you're an activist and then you say, well, I'm sorry that I challenged you. I'm sorry that I threatened your ego. I'm sorry that I threatened this, you know, ridiculously oppressive system that we're living within. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Then you're undoing all of your work, you know, and it sounds like you're aware of that, which is good. You know, don't undo your work and don't let people off the hook. People who need to take responsibility for their behavior, their actions, their thoughts, their stories about what it means to live in this country. You know, your job as you grow up and move into a leadership position in this country is to challenge people, and that you have to summon your fearlessness when you do that. And I think just writing this question to us and being out as a lesbian at your age shows that you have tremendous courage and just keep strengthening that, you know, don't back down.
It sounds like just putting it into practice and being aware of it. And yes, because I have all the faith in the world in you, Alex, just by what you wrote and what you're thinking, what you're feeling. So thank you for writing in and good luck out there. And Rebecca, our next question is from Mary. Mary writes, my daughter is getting married this year and shared her playlist for the reception with me. While I like hip hop, too many of the songs she's chosen contain really offensive language that I think is inappropriate for the wide age range of our guests. Is it okay to ask her to exclude those songs? Well,
absolutely. I think. What do you think, Tig? Do we differ? You go first.
It's hard because I feel like I, as a parent, would want to be very careful to not, quote unquote, ruin somebody's wedding day. And I would maybe, instead of asking them to exclude the songs, I might say, it is your day and I want you to be happy. There are songs that I do think will make some of our guests uncomfortable. And if you would kindly consider removing them from the playlist, or maybe putting them in the 1 a.m. hour, I would so much appreciate it. But it is your day, and you do what you want to do.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's a great approach. I think I would do something like that, and I would say, have you thought about these lyrics and what they mean, mm-hmm. and the implications of them in the culture, you know? And is this the energy that you want to bring to your wedding? You know, have you thought about that? And have you thought about how people will actually feel, and will they feel, and do you want to have them feeling that level of discomfort in this space that you are creating, which is about bringing your community and family together, mm-hmm. in a way that is not so fraught. You know, there's going to be plenty of time for fraught moments and discomfort, but at this moment, is it really worth it?
You know,
really plenty, so many. And is it really worth it to start your life together with these awkward moments that may make people, you know, very uncomfortable. But you want the energy to be elevated at a wedding. You want a sense of
joy.
Yeah, joy. You don't want it to be ordinary.
Yeah.
You don't want it to be like, you know, I could hear this out on the street, you know, like it's like, no, you know, I think I would be hardcore. I would say like, absolutely not. I am not in support of this. If you do this, you know, I will not be happy.
I still feel like you don't want to ruin their wedding, but you also don't want your kids to ruin their own wedding.
Yes. Yes. That's what I'm saying.
So just ask in an open, kind discussion with your child. Just walk her through those thoughts and ideas and feelings, and just to look a little further down the road in life. Is this really something great, great grandmother needs to hear on your beautiful wedding day?
And is this what you want to represent? You know, it's like, is this who you are? I think self-interrogation, you know, sort of self-inquiry is so important, and people forget to do that. You know, they're just sort of going along with the flow of the culture and not stopping to question what different food or music or, you know, television or anything, you know, what are those things doing to your mind? What do they mean to you? What do they represent to the world when you champion them? And I think those are conversations that need to start when your kids are very young.
And don't wait for the wedding day.
Yeah, don't wait for the wedding.
All right. Well, Mary, congratulations to you and your f***ing family. Rebecca, we have one more listener question left in the old mailbag. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Amanda writes, is it okay to look like a mess at home? I like to look presentable when I leave the house, but do my sloppy home looks mean I've let myself go? Are most people more concerned with their home style? Well, I've really let myself go a bit during the pandemic, to the point where some days I'll catch a glimpse of myself and I'll think, oh my gosh, I can't do this to Stephanie again. And I'll take a shower and I'll get dressed in a way that I know that she'll like, and I come downstairs, and every time I get that reaction from her where she's like, "Oh my gosh, you look so cute." And I haven't told her this, but she does listen to the podcast. But I do that for her every now and then, and I probably should pull it together a little more. But I don't know. What have you? No. Do you pull it together at the house?
I have a lot of Zoom meetings, so I kind of do have to pull it together during the pandemic and come down and da da da. But for the most part, I mean, I've been wearing like the same three pairs of pants for the last however many months. I've gone bananas with these like cozy cashmere sweaters that just keep coming in the mail. You know, I mean, I think it's important to be comfortable in your home. I think that there's one thing to just, you know, one thing is just to kind of give in and not wash your face and not brush your teeth and, you know, neglect basic hygiene. But I think being very comfortable and feeling safe enough to be comfortable in your home is important. You know, your home is a place where you should be able
you're
to
saying
just be yourself.
Brush and, your teeth, you know? But feel free to alternate between 2 to 3 pairs of pants for the rest of your life.
Pretty much. And then I do like the idea of dressing up for your person, you know, every now and again. I should probably do that more.
It's so fun to come downstairs and have Stephanie be like, "Oh my gosh," you know?
Yeah. And I will say that even in my coziness, I do like to look good for myself even, you know, I'd like to sort of spruce up and
you're a fancy cozy.
Yeah. Fancy cozy, chic cozy, you know, because it makes me feel better and my brain seems to work better. And I think there's a kind of ritual for me of adornment, of wanting to have beauty even in the comfort, and beauty being something that's very healing for me and inspiring, you know, like the earth. You know, if I don't have beauty, I feel like what's the point? Mm-hmm. So I try to bring that into my cozy at-home practice, you know, in one way or another. So I would recommend just making sure that, you know, even if you're, you know, not putting a lot of time into your clothes, that you find something that is inspiring to wear every day, whether it's a necklace or a ring, or you put a little lip balm on, or you have a beautiful orchid, you know, to look at. You know, I think that beauty is the most important thing.
Or a big bow on your head.
Yeah, or a big bow, exactly.
Yeah, I wonder if Amanda's listening to this thinking, listen, I wrote in asking if it's okay to look like a mess. And, you know, maybe she's living in squalor and we're just like, listen, get an orchid and put a bow in your hair. Take your shoes off and lounge on the couch.
That's really terrible.
And she's like, no, listen, raccoons live in my house. Is this okay? The raccoons are cooking me out.
No, you're so right, Tig. Oh, my God. No, you're so right. You're so right. Just whatever you've got going on, you know, just be as happy as you can possibly be.
Be happy.
Times are tough, you know?
Rotate between two pants, but brush your teeth and clean yourself and don't have the raccoons kick you to the curb because, you know... That's a whole different level, but make sure you're keeping up basic hygiene and I'm all for what you're saying, Rebecca, to have some beauty around you or splurge and get yourself something comfortable that maybe is somewhat attractive looking, but if that's not for you, just at least brush your teeth, okay? Amanda, how messy and gross are we talking about? Please send a picture in, okay? All right. Thanks for writing in, Amanda. And clean yourself. Rebecca, there's one more thing we have to do, and that's to take a real question from an advice column of yesteryear. And we try to do a little better. This is advice of yesteryear.
When Jerry brags about taking Ginny out, he learns that she dates all the boys.
So as we see now, menstruation is just one routine step in a normal and natural cycle.
How do you choose a date? Well, one thing you can consider is look.
I did everything you said, but my boss still hasn't asked me to lunch.
Okay, this question comes to us from 1947, from Eleanor Roosevelt's advice column, If You Ask Me. I was married 3 months ago, but up to this time, I haven't made any new friends because I'm just too shy. What can I do to stop feeling so uncomfortable with strangers? Rebecca, do you have any advice for this woman who just got married 74 years and 3 months ago?
So she's very shy. She's just got married and she's not making new friends.
Yeah, I'm getting the vibe that she gets up and gets dressed and ready and she probably pours tea into a china cup. This is how I'm picturing.
Right. I think she should go, like, meet some neighbors. Don't you think? I mean, she can't get on the internet.
No.
Right? I think she should go, you know, knock on her neighbors' doors and start making
and say help. God help me.
Invite them over for tea.
Oh my gosh. As you're talking about this, it is so interesting to think there is no internet, that this woman got married and is locked in this house and has no friends. And she hand wrote this letter, licked the envelope and stamp and sent it off to Eleanor Roosevelt in hopes of having some sort of assistance. But you're right. What else can she do but knock on the neighbor's door?
She's got to get really into the community. I mean, you know, she should knock on her next door neighbor's door. I mean, maybe she can host a book club, you know?
She's shy.
In her cul-de-sac. She's shy.
So is she really going to be the person that's going to draw a lot of people together? I don't know. But I'm all for go knock on the neighbor's door. I love my next door neighbors. They have become good friends of ours. In fact, they backed into one of our cars the other day and I was like, who cares?
She could also write a letter to the next door neighbor and slip it under their door or, you know, in their mailbox. Just write a little note if she's so shy and say,
I'm shy,
but I'm desperate for friends. I'm stuck in the house with this guy that I married 3 months ago. It may or may not have been a good idea. It's unclear, you know, but, you know, you must be in the same boat. So why don't we get together and read a book and have some tea and then, you know,
oh my God,
be really honest about our experiences.
That is really something to think about.
I know. I mean, what did Eleanor say?
Eleanor said, remember, first of all, that your husband fell in love with you and married you and that he is proud of you. That should give you some assurance. Try to forget how you feel and think only of how your guests feel and your shyness will soon disappear. Eleanor, please. I don't.
Well, I'm sort of into the idea of saying, you know, remember that your husband, you know, loves you and allow that to sort of bolster your self-esteem.
I don't like remember that he's proud of you.
Yeah, the proud of you thing sucks. We don't like that.
No, that
I know.
No, thank you.
No, we don't like that. But I think that there's something about reminding someone that their person chose them and saw qualities in them that are really worthwhile and attractive. And, you know, and I was thinking when I first heard it, you know, that hopefully your husband can be your best friend. You know, I think that's one of the joys of real partnership, as I found, you know, that, Rachel is my best friend. And so to build on the friendship that you can forge with your partner can be quite helpful and help you feel less alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you bring it to him, you know, you say like, I'm really feeling like I'm alone and I need friends and, you know, work on your friendship with him. I don't know. And then go next door.
Yeah, I bet he probably said, why don't you go knock on the neighbor's door? I got work to do.
I know. This poor woman, I wish she had like Facebook or Insta. I mean, I like the knocking on the door. I think that's the best idea. Or writing a little note.
Yeah, I think
to someone.
I think that's
right?
In line.
I think that's,
yeah. And it yeah. And as you were,
I don't like the idea of not thinking about yourself when you're with other people and just, and your shyness will go away, thinking about them and their experience. That seems kind of, I mean, I guess it's like a fake it till you make it kind of thing, but I don't want to suggest that people be separate from what they're feeling, you know?
Yeah, and I think that if she begins knocking on neighbors' doors and making friends, the more she gets to know the people, I think that her shyness will disappear once she knows them individually and in a group. I think she'll really shine. Oh, Rebecca, that brings yes. us to the end of our episode.
No.
I know.
That's how it is. Impermanence.
Yeah, we solved a lot of people's problems, and I really can't express enough how much I appreciate you doing the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you
everywhere and every time?
Do you have anything you'd like to promote before we get out of here?
I do have a new book called What's Your Story? A Journal for Everyday Evolution, which is a really intense, rigorous, guided journal that's supposed to designed to help people rewrite the stories of their lives and let go of old ideas about who they are and how they relate to their bodies and their minds and the community and their death and technology. And I'm really happy about that. But mostly I just want to promote happiness and sanity right now. I want everyone out there to just try to hold on until we can all be with one another again. You know, I think that's the most important
yes.
thing to
hold on.
Hope.
Well,
hold on, honey. Hold on.
Thank you, Rebecca. And
all right.
I will hopefully see you in the flesh sooner than later.
Yes, please. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Don't Ask Tig is hosted by me, Tig Notaro. It's produced by Thomas Ouellette, Tracy Mumford, Whitney Jones, and Shayna Deloria. Our editor is Phyllis Fletcher. Executive producer, Lauren D. Engineering and sound mixing by Eric Romani. Digital production by Christina Lopez. Talent booking by Marianne Ways. Production support from Pizza Shark. Our theme music is Friend and Tig by Edie Burkell and Kyle Cresham. And Listen to Your Heart by Edie Burkell. Special thanks to Hunter Seidman, Lily Kim, and Alex Schaffert. Concept developed by Tracy Mumford. Our executive consultant is Dean Capello and Gobsmack Studios. You can always ask for advice at don'asktig.org. Just write in with your problem or send us a voice memo. You can also follow us on social media at Don't Ask Tig. Don't Ask Tig is a production of American Public Media. And as always, thanks, Dana, and I'll tell Becky. Hi, I'm stand-up comedian and sex symbol Tig Notaro.
And I'm actor and writer Cheryl Hines.
Before Cheryl and I got into the big business of podcasting together, we were just simply friends.
And we're still friends. But now we talk about a different documentary every week on our podcast, Tig and Cheryl, True Story. So whether you love documentaries or just want to hear us slowly lose our minds, check out Tig and Cheryl, True Story, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, cool.